This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Welcome back to the 430 Movie. We got our expert programmers here to curate fantasy theme weeks of classic films.
From 1998, film directed by Steven Soderbergh called Out of Sight.
Yes!
Soderbergh directs it with such a sort of confident, self-assured style.
Lex Luthor in Superman.
What is it about Gene Hackman that...
His performance, it's off the charts, but still in reality. Fiendishly gifted.
1981, Sam Raimi opus, The Evil Dead.
Okay. Oh, yes, right? Fine choice.
Sam Raimi invented entirely new ways to get shots that should not have been possible with the amount of money that he did not have.
Charade.
Yeah. Oh, so
directed
good.
By Stanley Donen. It's a textbook screenplay. It's just effortless, and there's not a wrong note in this movie. Can't say enough great things about it. We'll be back next Friday with an all-new episode of the 430 Movie, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Join us now for the 430 Movie.
The 430 Movie podcast is available weekly wherever you listen to podcasts and on the free Electric Now app. Download it today.
Hello and welcome to Best Movies Never Made, the podcast where we talk about interesting and infamous movies that never made it to or through production. Most of the time, the movies you're trying to make don't get made.
Like, four of them may happen, one of them may happen, none of them may happen, and I'll be attached to three more things by end of summer.
Turn the script into something resembling like Unforgiven with Conan.
Yeah.
Sadly, the rights expired and the whole thing just like went away overnight.
New episodes will be available every other Monday. We won't see you at the movies.
Best Movies Never Made, as featured in Entertainment Weekly, is available wherever you listen to podcasts and on the free Electric Now app. If you think you felt a great disturbance in the force, you're not wrong. Ed Gross and me, Mark A. Altman, have a new oral history from St. Martin's Press. It's Secrets of the Force, the complete, uncensored, unauthorized oral history of the Star Wars saga. So wherever you buy books, audio, and video, pick it up today, and you can learn the secrets of the Force. And don't miss our oral history of Star Trek in stores now. And of course, nobody does it better, the complete oral history of James Bond in digital, hardcover, paperback, and audio. That is all. Hey, this is Mark A. Altman.
And this is Darren Doctorman. And we are the inglorious
Trekspurts. And today we're talking, when is a Trek not a Trek? Indeed. We're talking movies that weren't Star Trek movies, but could have been. The best Star Trek movies that weren't Star Trek movies. Yeah. So it's going to be a really interesting conversation. But before we do that, I have to apologize for something I said on last week's show before we go any further. So I asked myself and you guys the question, what do we feel is the most underrated Bond movie? And, you know, in the heat of the moment, I said Octopussy at the time. And I thought about it after we were off the air. And clearly, the correct answer is Thunderball. Thunderball is a movie that everybody complains about how slow it is at the end with the underwater stuff and everything. I love Thunderball. I think that, yeah, that stuff is a little slow, but it's spectacular. And Sean Connery is fantastic in it. Luciana Paluzzi is Fiona Volp. I love that movie, and people really always tend to bag on it. So that clearly it should be my choice. So I just want to correct the record before we move on with this week's show.
The fact that you thought it was that important to correct.
It kept me up at night.
Is a little bit of concern to me. I'm just, you know, I mean, we all love things very strongly, but take a deep breath.
Well, I did. You know, okay. I guess it's Bond is on my mind because, of course, as this airs, It's the day that the new Bond movie has opened at theaters, No Time to Die. I saw it today when we're recording, which is about a week before. I'm not going to say anything, no spoilers here. But, you know, Bond is on my mind. Let's put it that way. And I'm sure we can have a more substantial discussion once you've all seen it.
Perhaps on the 4:30 movie.
Yeah. I'm kind of in that phase, like when I was the first person to see Phantom Menace, right before I left for Cannes.
Uh-oh.
And I came out of the screening and saw people online and felt like Kevin McCarthy in Invasion of the Body Snatchers, got on a plane to the Cannes Film Festival and wasn't able to talk to anybody.
I think you've answered the question without answering it.
About it. It was very frustrating. And then I'm in that situation now. I know a couple people at the screening. Our good friend Scott Mance was there, a couple other people who I've talked to, but until the movie premieres next week, I'm not going to say anything more. So there you go. We still have the Beatles. So, okay. So anyway, Ashley Miller is back with us, fully registered and licensed to track
and rested and ready.
Yeah. So of course, fans of Ashley know him as the showrunner of the hit Netflix series Dota: Dragon's Blood.
So do enemies of Ashley, by the way.
Yes,
so
yes, they do. My enemies, especially.
Been a writer on such shows as Fringe and Black Sails. He was a writer of Thor and X-Men First Class. But most important of all, he is now a newly minted, still new.
Minty fresh.
It's only been a month and a half. I mean, until my leg starts to feel better. The Vegas convention was still recent. So I would say that Ashley is still a newly minted, recent official track expert.
You of all people should realize the danger of reopening old wounds.
Oh, let me tell you. I wish it would go away. That I can't put that convention behind me because.
Let it go.
I would like to. I would like to. But today we're not here to talk about Vegas.
I was there when you sustained your old Star Trek injury.
The old wound.
The old wound.
One land, one king. It was an Excalibur kind of weekend. Not only were you knighted and made a Trekspert, but the old wound I was victimized by the old wound.
Well, we're doing Star Trek now, so it's more like an Excalibur kind of weekend.
And Darren was kind of like Lancelot at that convention. So, you know, all in all, the only thing is it didn't take place at the Excalibur. It took place at the Rio.
That's right.
Almost as bad. So, anyway, but we're here to talk about movies that could have been Star Trek movies, or I guess a way of looking at it is movies that provide a good template for a Star Trek movie in a way. There's something about them that feels Star Trek-y, if I may use that as
Star
an Trek-y, adjective. Star Trek-y. Just as you could, argue that certain movies have the feeling of a Bond movie. Maybe not No Time for Die, but you could argue, you know, Funeral in Berlin and the Harry Palmer movies, you know, they feel like a Bond movie without being a Bond movie. And so same thing with Star Trek. They're movies that are almost more Star Trek than Star Trek, more human than human.
When you were mentioning that list, I sort of realized that I really want to see Harry Palmer and the Sorcerer's Stone.
He'd have the glasses and everything. That would be, I'd like to see that too.
Are you a muggle?
You know, it's funny because Michael Caine, I think, was the only respected, prestigious English actor not in a Harry Potter movie. Yeah. So this could be his big chance. They're rebooting the franchise. Okay. So moving right along. By the way, Ashley, welcome back. Good to have you.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
How's things going in Hollywood Land this week?
You know what? Things in Hollywood Land are A-OK.
By the way, I have to say, this is the day we record. It's the 34th anniversary of the broadcast of Encounter at Farpoint.
Yeah.
Wow.
Which we just celebrated on the show when we talked about the Bible. But
The book.
Yeah.
I remember quivering with excitement, waiting for that show to begin. And
then at the end, quivering more.
quivering. He's still quivering. Exactly.
Well, you know, John Pike, the executive Paramount, famously said, "What the hell was that?" And I just watched. And I kind of felt that way after seeing it. Although after watching Naked Now the following week, I was reappraising my feelings about Farpoint. Oh, that wasn't too bad. You know, but, you know, look, I think even at Farpoint, there was a sense that the template was there for something better. Yeah. You know, like they had stuck the landing in terms of reinterpreting and extending the original series and making it feel fresh, but still keeping so much of what we loved about it. So even though Farpoint in a way was not a complete success in so many ways, it also didn't feel like, created by people who hated the franchise, who were trying to turn it into something it's not.
Who were embarrassed by science fiction.
Right. Or James Bond. Oh, wait. No, yes. By science fiction. Yes. So
or think that an evil twin is a new idea.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, it's interesting because, of course, you do get that weird combination of the Gene Roddenberry Q story and then Dorothy's Farpoint Station story. It's interesting because at the time, everyone really disliked the Q story. You know, they felt it was sort of warmed over Squire of Gothos. And it's interesting that the Q story is and Q as a character is the character that has endured all these many years.
Right. It's like now you look at it as, you know, that line where he says, you know, "I think this mission at Farpoint will provide an excellent test." You know, I'm kind of like, it's really like it's more of a mediocre test, you know, but the fact that that all of that came back, that Q, the trial, all of that came back and all good things suddenly makes Encounter at Farpoint better in retrospect, at least in those scenes, right? Because then it makes the entire series feel like the test. Like, oh, okay. It's not just like the squid hug.
But it's right? also testing us.
Yes. Yes, it is. That is an excellent test of us.
Yes.
I was going to say exactly what you said, which is the that all good things, you know, a rising tide lifts all boats, that all good things elevates Farpoint, that Farpoint now is better in retrospect because of all good things.
Yes.
You know, the way it utilized Farpoint, you know, which was super clever. Yeah. I mean, all good things, you know, one day I know we did an episode where we talked about best Star Trek pilots and finales, but, you know, all good things is really in that pantheon of great finales, like Breaking Bad, like Six Feet Under, not like The Sopranos. Yep. It's a real testament to Brandon and Ron and Michael who you know did that. Anyway, so we're talking about Star Trek movies that aren't Star Trek movies. That in a sense, there's something about them. There's a quality. I guess it's a hopefulness, an optimism, a relationship between the characters, maybe even a Shakespearean quality that. An operatic quality that we feel evokes the feeling of Star Trek. So what I'd love to do is sort of hear your choices for the best Star Trek movies that aren't Star Trek movies. I'm going to start with, I was going to say Mr. Monday, Steve Belching, but he's not here. I'm going to start with Darren Dockerman, my co-host, and see what his pick is. We have not discussed this before the show, so this is all going to be a big surprise, or is it?
Now, I'm going to pull a Mark Altman and give a couple that I didn't select.
Good idea.
I know everyone expects me to choose the lovely Master and Commander, The Far Side of the World, not only because it's a great Star Trek movie, but because I worked on it. I'm not going to, however. I'll leave that to scholars.
Just a broken arm, sir.
You're in very good hands. 7 weeks sailing, and he happened on our exact position.
Well, then perhaps he was looking for us.
Damn, he was good.
An act of war will cripple them.
With basic repairs, we can get home as we are.
We're not going home.
The power of nature will threaten them.
Our enemy has more than twice our guns,
more than twice our numbers, and we are supposed to stop it.
Torn between fulfilling his duty.
Captain's not called Lucky Jack for no reason. Phantom or no, Lucky Jack will have it.
In the lives of the men he commands.
Steady!
He must face the invincible.
fight like you, Jack. A hunter becomes the hunted.
Well then, there's not a moment to lose.
Inches, sir. The men would follow you anywhere. As a friend, I would say that we should have turned back weeks ago.
It's leadership they want. Strength. Find that within yourself, and you will earn their respect. Board, you'll take him out of the ship.
Take him out of the ship. Thank you, sir.
For home and for the prize.
Stay after us.
Let's fly.
But I am going to pick a high seas adventure. And it is something that...
Why don't you pick Juicy Juice?
Well, because of the Ecto Cooler.
Okay, got it.
No, it's something that Roddenberry himself voiced as an inspiration. The books that this film is based on are excellent. The miniseries that was made from these is even better. But the original film... with Gregory Peck, who is apparently Spock's grandfather, playing Captain Horatio Hornblower.
All starboard watch! Secure the guns! Hands aloft to secure!
Unfurling all the romance and excitement of C.S. Forrester's mighty saga of the seas, Warner Brothers take you before the mast with the greatest naval hero of all time. In the fabulous days when iron men hurled wooden ships into mortal combat, when history hung on the slash of a sword, and only one man stood between the tyrant Bonaparte and his dream of world conquest, Captain Horatio Hornblower, who'd advance into the fury of 1,000 cannon, but retreated at the smile of one beautiful woman.
When you tried to make me leave the ship, oh, Captain, and no heart, I thought. Oh, every mile closer to England is agony for me.
If I am not back aboard the Lydia within 1 hour, she'll train her guns upon your fort and reduce it to rubble.
With you in it, Captain?
That is my order. We'll load with chain shot. I want those four Frenchmen dismasted. We'll close to point-blank range and take them in succession.
And it is a wonderful, it's definitely a Hollywood movie. So a lot of the worse aspects of sea voyages are sort of smoothed over, and it's not a realistic portrayal, but it is a very adventurous and wonderful character piece. And Peck is amazing. And it is very much, as you're watching it, you can very much imagine our Star Trek characters participating in it. Mm.
That's a great choice.
I really like it, and it's a lot of fun. But if you can find the BBC, I think it was BBC, series that was made in, I believe, the 90s. It's amazing. And it takes all the stages of Hornblower's naval career, and features them in each season. And it's really well done.
You know, it's interesting because I think and I can't speak for what Ashley's going to say or what you may say in the future, that as much as people call Star Trek wagon train to the stars, and Star Trek was dramatically influenced by TV Westerns, really the movies that we're going to see that influenced Star Trek or that could be Star Trek are mostly sea, ocean movies, not just, naval movies, sub movies. It's no accident that something like Balance of Terror was, a take on Run Silent, Run Deep, yeah. Or The Enemy Below. So I think it's interesting that it really is these sort of naval movies and sub movies. And, you mentioned Master Commander. I'm sure we're going to talk about that more so than the Westerns. I don't even think that there are a lot of Westerns that come to mind where I think that feels like Star Trek to me.
Only in the fact that Westerns usually had a very moral core to them, mm-hmm. and that the main characters usually were, at least the earlier ones, that the characters had a very moral center to them, and they did things based on a code.
Come back, Spock.
Yes, come back. Plus, they were about, some of them were, but not all of them, but very often, especially when you're talking about wagon train, is about going somewhere, right? Yeah. It's going into the frontier. Going into the frontier, going out like into the unknown, and it's dangerous. And like the only thing that you have to rely on, the only thing that you do know, are the people who are making the journey with you. And how you experience that together, forms the heart of the drama. So, I by the way, completely agree that most of the influences, I think, on at least in terms of, how we think about Star Trek stories, like specific beats and stories, probably come from like these movies that are about the sea, right? Like some of which, like you named them, are gonna be Tuesday. But I think that it is not unfair to say that Gene was correct when he said it was wagon train to the stars. That those things were, I think, a real intangible influence on what Star Trek became.
Yeah. And, Star Trek II, for instance, isn't just influenced by Hornblower, but it's also really influenced, obviously, by Moby Dick. So, absolutely. Again,
a little too much.
So I guess in a way, the real animated version of Star Trek is Octonauts.
Yeah, the Octonauts movie. Yeah. Dude, there's a Wednesday.
Yeah, it's funny because... you look at something like The Searchers, which is a movie, a John Ford movie I obviously really like, and I think it would make a fabulous, there's a sci-fi version of it, but there's probably not a Star Trek version of it.
Right? There was on Deep Space Nine. I think it was M'Elora. I could be wrong. No, it wasn't M'Elora. No, it was, crap. M'Elora was absolutely not the episode.
No, that was the Bashir one about, love interest with the wheelchair. Yeah.
But it was the one about
that hit me in the knee.
Yes. Dukat's daughter.
Yes.
Right.
Oh, yeah. That's right. Well, Ira Bear is such a huge fan of old movies, classic movies, I should say. I don't believe in old movies, classic movies.
Classics.
And classics. And like so it's us. Not surprising.
We're gonna be classics someday.
Gonna be.
Classic Trekspers.
Is it possible that we have grown so old as to outlive our usefulness?
It's absolutely
would that constitute possible. A joke?
Story okay. with a humorous climax.
So great pick in Horatio Hornblower. So Ashley, on our sister show, The Fourth Day Moon, you're known for your out of the box, crazy picks. No one is expecting that from you today, but I'm just saying, don't feel obligated to deliver insanity. We're here for you. We were looking at the subject seriously, and love to know. What do you think is a Star Trek movie that's not a Star Trek movie?
So it's interesting that you kind of brought up the connections to movies about the sea, because originally my pick was going to be The Enemy Below, which I think you can draw a lot of one-to-one comparisons between The Enemy Below and Balance of Terror, like almost like beat for beat. And you know what? That's fine, right? Because good poets borrow, great poets steal. Imitation is, in fact, the sincerest form of flattery. The Enemy Below is like, it's a really great movie from 1957. It's like, it's like freaking Robert Mitchum, man. Like, how can you beat Robert Mitchum as Captain Kirk other than, William Shatner's Captain Kirk. Like, you can't. Like, it's great. It's and you know, you mentioned Run Silent, Run Deep. Frankly, I think there's an argument for something, believe it or not, for Das Boot, right? Which is absolutely like just this amazing underwater adventure, like that so seduces you into the plight of that crew that when at the end of the film, they surface and they get bombed by the British, like you're shaking your fist at the Brits and they go, oh,
wait a minute.
Whoops. Right. It's like, that's how effective that movie is.
See, you can't say Das Boot. You know why you can't say Das Boot?
Because it was a miniseries on TV.
No. You can't say it because we can't run a clip. Because the whole clip will be in German and no one will understand what the hell the clip is. So
fine. So then here's what this format has done to me, right? Like, and this is where, like, I think it was a mistake to say, like, let's do it like the 4:30 movie. Because there's a thing that happens in my brain. There is a like a neuron that just fires. Mm-hmm. And you tripped it. You tripped it.
There is a fifth dimension.
Exactly. And I think so.
I think he's more like the eighth dimension and the red Letroids.
Where are we going? Planet 10 or Wednesday. When are we going there? Real soon. By the way, kinda?
Maybe. Right? I could see it. It's not on my list, but now that you mention it.
There's a crew, there's a captain, there's aliens. It's like it's
and
all
wherever
about
you go, there you are. There you are. Could you see Shatner doing that at the beginning instead of to boldly go?
Yes, but I can't see him playing the flugelhorn.
No, that's true.
No, that's but true. I can see him asking, is there someone out there crying in the dark?
Crying in the dark.
Wherever right? you go, there you are.
Don't be mean. We don't need
to. Purpose of time is so that everything doesn't happen at once. So here's my
and I could see Spock with his tricorder. Why is there a watermelon over there? You're scanning.
Wait, is it? Yes. We should nuke Russia.
Is he making fun of me?
Just
Boute.
Yeah. Right. Yeah,
Big Boute.
Shit, man. Now I'm thinking Buckaroo Banzai is not a bad pick. Although here's my out of the box pick. I think it works up until the very ending where it suddenly horrifically stops working.
All right.
But it's kind of fun. Right now it goes from this interpretation of Star Trek that a representative of civilization and morality as we understand it ventures to a land where, you know, the people and culture is somewhat recognizable but different in very important ways. And this civilization, this culture has a secret. The secret is dangerous. It puts our hero in danger.
Insurrection.
Our hero has an objective that's laudable. There's a twist that gets our hero captured, right? And it's coming to understand the nature of the civilization and the culture and the relationship between that culture and civilization as we understand it, that is the key to understanding the story. Now, all of this describes the movie that's on my mind really well and kind of fits that Star Trek mold up until, well, let me put it this way. A Star Trek episode never ended with Captain Kirk inside of a giant wicker man being set on fire.
Didn't it though?
And Mark is like, oh my God, what have we done?
Worse than Any Which Way But Loose.
Every Which Way But Loose.
Yeah, that, whatever.
Right. I didn't pick Any Which Way You Can. I just want everybody to understand that. But isn't that fascinating? Right now, for the record, that was not my pick until you mentioned The Enemy Below. I just felt like that was going to be my interesting discussion followed by my pick, but now my pick was kind of taken and that became the interesting discussion. But look in a more serious way of looking at it, right? It's like, why doesn't that fit the template? And the reason why is that, look, there's a lot of things that track, that make sense, right? Edward Woodward is the representative of law.
The equalizer.
Right. He's also the equalizer, but he is civilization, right? He goes into a situation that he does not understand. And yeah. It's the things that he does not understand that create the conflict, that create the story. That culture is the thing that's interesting, right? That culture is the thing that creates the story problem. But where it becomes different is it's not just that it ends in a dark way, right? It's not just that, like, that he ends up dead at the end. Spoiler alert, if you haven't seen The Wicker Man, okay? Mm-hmm. The thing that I think, and this is why I actually even would argue against something like Das Boot, is that there is a nihilism at the heart of something like The Wicker Man, right? And there is no nihilism in Star Trek as we understand it. Sometimes it goes to dark places. Sometimes our characters make dark and difficult choices. But at the end of the day, right, Star Trek never posits that the barbarians make it past the gate and destroy civilization, and that civilization is a thing that, like, should not be upheld or cannot withstand it.
Right.
Like, there is, and again, I'm not even arguing that, like, because some of my favorite episodes of Star Trek Deep Space Nine are dark, but it's why I would say that even something like Das Boot, which in so many levels feels like it could be a Star Trek story, ultimately isn't, because the mission is doomed, right? And the mission in Star Trek is never doomed or shouldn't be doomed. I mean, I realize that there are Star Trek series that are entirely based on the premise that the mission is doomed, but maybe they shouldn't be. So the truth of the matter is, if I were going to pick a submarine movie, right? I would go for something more like The Hunt for Red October.
The most brilliant commander in the Soviet Navy.
Ramey has trained most of their officer corps. He's nearly a legend in the submarine community.
The most deadly submarine ever built.
This thing could park a couple of hundred warheads off Washington. Nobody'd know a thing about it until it was all over.
And once more, we play our dangerous game
with our old adversaries, the American Navy.
His plan is a mystery.
A man with your responsibilities reading about the end of the world.
Apparently, he has suffered a kind of nervous breakdown in which he announced his intention to fire his missiles on the United States.
You want us to help you hunt him down, kill him.
Open the outer doors, firing point procedures.
We sail into history.
I'm going to blow him right to Mars.
Ramius might be trying to defect.
You're just an analyst. What can you possibly know what goes on in this mine?
I'll give you 3 days to prove your theory correct.
I am not field personnel. I am only an analyst.
You're perfect.
I'm expendable.
He's defecting.
You willing to bet your life on that?
From the best-selling novel by Tom Clancy. From the director of Die Hard.
Give this man a chance.
My orders are specific.
Battle stations.
Sean Connery, Alec Baldwin, James Earl Jones, Scott Glenn, Sam Neill. The Hunt for Red October.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Because that is a movie where we go into the unknown, right? Like, where we meet our enemy, where we befriend our enemy, where we realize that we have more in common with them than we ever knew. And that together, you know, we solve a problem, and there is excitement, there is action, right? There are real stakes, and it feels big. You know, it's just, and to me,
well,
like,
you know, I mean, in a way, Next Generation did that with The Defector, where right. James Sloyan plays a Romulan defector who's defecting to the Federation, but they're not sure if he's really defecting or not. Obviously, right. It's done on a much smaller scale because, right. You know, it's a $1.5 million show. Right. You know, that had to take place mostly on the ship. But you could compare that, I think, to Hunt for Red October.
Yeah, but go ahead.
It brings up this secondary question that is, you know, not when a show is like Star Trek. It's a story that we would like to see as a Star Trek.
Exactly.
And I think there are a lot of those that we would like to see, and maybe we can talk about that a little later.
Yeah. You sound like in Trouble with Tribbles, something we want to see as Star Trek.
I'm not saying your movie is
I'm not Star saying Trek. Your movie sucks. But yeah, that's a really good point, Darren. You know, it's interesting because you talk about the idea that, you know, there are times where Star Trek did what a lot of shows did back in the 60s, which is rip off a popular movie.
Sure.
And the original series obviously did it so well in Bounds of Terror with the Enemy Below. They did it really well in the Galileo 7 where they ripped off sort of Flight of the Phoenix,
right.
You know, which I compare to something like Battlestar Galactica 1978, full disclosure, a show that I love. But it did things like Fire in Space, which was a ripoff of Towering Inferno. In fact, it even right. used footage from the Towering Inferno, which is awful, right? It's just awful. I mean, even Gun on Ice Planet Zero, which is kind of fun, is basically doing Guns of Navarone. And the problem is Guns of Navarone doesn't make any sense in space where you can go in any direction and there's a giant gun that's going to shoot down the fleet. You have
one
to
one gun.
Between these, the, you know, paths between these planets where the gun will shoot you down. There's no way to go around it. It's like, oh my gosh. No,
because it will ravish all.
Yeah, the ravish all pulsar. it's called a pulsar. I don't know why that is.
Is it? Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
I don't remember.
Yeah, the ravish all. Dan O'Hurley, though.
All I, it was Howard Hughes' favorite episode.
He would. That's you. Now you're talking about Ice Days and Ukraine. You're talking about memories. But the thing is, it's funny you say that because I had a pick for my pick, and during the course of our conversation, I said, "No, I'm going to go with Ice Station Zebra." So it's funny you bring that up because Ice Station Zebra was largely written, adapted the Alistair MacLean story, adapted by Paddy Chayefsky. So it takes this kind of potboiler espionage thriller and elevates it. With this incredible dialogue, Paddy Chayefsky-esque dialogue. So, and then you have Patrick McGoohan, who's so good in it. And Rock Hudson basically doing a Shatner-esque Kirk kind of captain, or maybe Pike. He's sort of a combination of Pike and Kirk.
Beneath the waters of the North Atlantic, the American nuclear submarine Tigerfish 3 begins its voyage to the Arctic camp. Their destination, a secret outpost at the top of the world. Ice Station Zebra.
Take her up.
Their orders are to beat the Russians. On board, one man is determined to stop them.
Oh, I've already vouched for Mr. Vaslov. As for me, you can safely eliminate me.
Why?
Oh, you must.
Why?
By a logical absurdity. Haven't you forgotten, Captain, I'm in charge of this operation. Those orders come to you from your chief of naval operations and direct to him from your president. So before we go any further, I suggest that you get me there, put another torpedo up the spout, blow a hole in the ice,
and get me there!
And then you arrive at Ice Station Zebra. And the action really begins.
But
nice ice station he got here, Mr. Pike.
but McGoohan, who, you know, you're not sure exactly, he's a mysterious, you know, enigmatic figure.
Patrick McGowan.
You know, it's like in The Prisoner, he's so great. He's so great. And it has this incredible cast. It's like Jim Brown and Ernest Borgnine and who else is in it? Because it's just this amazing cast. But it totally has the feel. In fact, I think it was our good friend Alan Spencer who first turned me on to this movie. He said, "Oh, you got to watch Ice Station Zebra. It's like watching a really great episode of the original Star Trek." And it's like the Enterprise, and you know, there's kind of like the scene where you know they're sinking and they have to save the ship. We need more power, right. And And there's, you know, the Russians in that movie might as well be the Klingons. So that to me totally fits the paradigm we're talking about completely.
Agreed. I like that pick.
Yeah. It's really, and for those in the audience, look, I know we talk about stuff very esoteric. If you have not seen Ice Station Zebra, you should really watch it. It's super fun. And if you're a fan of the original series, you'll probably really get a kick out of it. It's really good. It really feels like a Star Trek, like a Star Trek episode. So many.
It's true that Howard Hughes loved that movie. In fact, he loved it so much that he bought a local TV station in Las Vegas and told them to just play that movie every night. Yeah. And he would watch it from his suite in a hotel in Vegas. And it's a wild story.
Yeah, it really is a wild story. And I know, you know, all these Howard Hughes biopics, you know, they always want to put that story in, and I guess it never makes its way in. But yeah, how he would watch Ice Station Zebra every night, every day. And it never gets old.
Lovely. I mean, it's like one of us, you know, watching Star Trek all the time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Who would do that?
I don't know.
Yeah, who would do that?
How many times between us have we seen Star Trek 2, do we think?
Between all of us?
Yeah.
I would say conservatively, I've probably seen it maybe about 170 times.
Easily.
Yeah. Yeah. I would think, you know, and if I really did the math.
The times that you play it in your mind.
Yeah. That's true. That's true.
I'm just going to sit back, close my eyes, and watch Star. Honey, what are you doing?
In my mind.
Star Trek 2. Hold on. It's my favorite part.
Well, and then look, obviously we can't do a show like this without mentioning, but I don't know if the show fits the paradigm because it clearly inspired Star Trek more than, you know, so it's not really a Star Trek movie. It's not Star Trek, but it's Forbidden Planet, of course.
Yeah, of course.
But the Forbidden Planet is the cage. So yes. I'm not sure if it really qualifies for this or if it absolutely does, but it's more that Star Trek was influenced by Forbidden Planet than Forbidden Planet is a Star Trek.
Imagine yourself as one of the crew of this faster-than-light spaceship of the future, sharing their curiosity to know the unknown, their tension, their readiness for inconceivable adventures.
Sir, we're being radar scanned.
United Planets cruiser C-57D, J.J. Adams commanding. Who are you?
Morbius of the Bellerophon.
Well, Dr. Morbius, my orders are to survey the situation on Altair 4.
Commander, if you sat down on this planet, I warn you that I cannot be answerable for the safety of your ship or your crew.
Well, it's certainly a Star Trekian story that is not Star Trek.
I like to think of it as taking place in the Star Trek universe.
That's interesting. But Captain, I mean, Robert, I don't disagree. April. I'm just saying that, like,
Yeah, that's interesting. I love the idea of it taking place in the Star Trek universe.
Whereas by the same token, right? Like, just to kind of, this is like the thought experiment to kind of to differentiate, like, Forbidden Planet, kind of what makes that feel Star Trekian. I would never accuse 2001 of being Star Trek.
Right.
It's like, because, and I mean, and look, my I nearly like it feelings about it are on record, but it's just, it's not the same. It doesn't have the same humanist interest.
It's not about characters. It's about humanity.
Right.
Yes.
It's the focus of it.
Yeah.
But that's why people would compare the motion picture to 2001, because it's about big ideas. But even the motion picture is more about character than 2001.
100%. I think I don't know if there's been any discussions on this podcast about Star Trek the motion picture, but I think that
Secret Project?
Right. Yeah, the Secret Project. But that we could all agree that our favorite stuff in that movie is like character is stuff. All the character shit.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, okay.
I stand corrected.
I'd like to bring up something if we don't just to throw this out. It's not a movie. It's a miniseries from 1977, Shogun.
Shogun, James Clavell's number one international bestseller. Shogun, the Emmy Award-winning television masterpiece. The unforgettable epic of two warlords battling with destiny, creating a civilization for all time. The honor and the horror. The power and the passion. The beauty and the tragedy. Richard Chamberlain, Toshiro Mifune. A six-part epic presentation that is Shogun.
Oh, that's interesting. Shogun. That's interesting.
That's a great Star Trek series. Story. Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Star Trek story. Absolutely. You can just imagine, you know, Captain Kirk in the title role being stranded on a Klingon planet and having to learn their ways and survive.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a fascinating idea if you look at it with that lens that you can make really good Star Trek stories that haven't been done yet.
It's like a good version of the Paradise Syndrome,
right? Exactly. I am Kirok.
Exactly.
That's actually a pretty good band name.
I am Kirok.
I am Kirok.
Yeah.
Although, I mean, we saw those shirts at Vegas. Edith Keeler Must Die. I think that's a better band name.
That's a great band name.
I don't know why I didn't get one of those shirts for my wife. It's just like, because those were cool.
Yeah.
What was the name of that company? I got to check out their website. I want an Edith Keeler Must Die shirt. I'm going to start a band and I don't even know how to play an instrument just so I can call my band Edith Keeler Must Die.
Many people have done that kind of thing.
That's right. That's true. So, anyway, I'll play harmonica. So, I was going to say the only thing about that's a great choice to Shogun, by the way, that Forbidden Planet would be on a Rosetta Stone with Wagon Train when you we talk about the DNA of Star Trek, right? But when we look at these other movies that could be Star Trek movies but weren't, obviously a lot of people can say to us, you haven't mentioned Galaxy Quest yet, which a lot of people call the best Star Trek movie. That's the best Star Trek movie. Period. I don't think it is.
I don't think it is.
I think it's fun.
It's a very entertaining movie that makes us think about Star Trek.
Right.
In the far reaches of the galaxy, a civilization is under siege.
We are all that is left.
They've searched the universe for a leader.
Stay tuned for scenes from next week's Galaxy Quest.
Never give up. Never surrender.
He will save us.
What they got.
Never give up and never surrender.
We're struggling TV actors.
You are our last hope.
Where's my limo?
Okie dokie.
Acting like heroes.
The whole thing was just a misunderstanding.
May not be enough.
They look like little children. Hi, little guy.
I'm done.
DreamWorks Pictures presents Tim Allen, Sigourney Weaver, Alan Rickman. Galaxy Quest.
You're just gonna have to kill it.
Well, go for the mouth, the throat, his vulnerable spots.
It's a rock, it doesn't have any vulnerable spots.
And even if it were, it only exists because Star Trek is a context for it.
Yes.
Right? Which is almost automatically disqualifying for the purposes of this conversation.
Right.
And I've said this before, if anything, to me, it evokes the memories of this wonderful short story from Star Trek New Voyages from the 70s called Voyage to a Small Planet Revisited,
correct,
which is about William Shatner and Leonard Nimoy and Dee Forest Kelly finding themselves on the real Enterprise. And Galaxy Quest to me is that story come to life. And that's lovely. And it doesn't take away from Galaxy Quest, but it doesn't make it the greatest Star Trek movie ever because it's an homage, just like Free Enterprise isn't the greatest Star Trek movie ever.
Since Mark was a boy, and since Robert was a boy, they've worshipped one man.
The Laurence Olivier of the airways.
What are you doing here?
I'm one of the top 10 imaginary friends kids have, just behind John Travolta, Reggie Jackson, and Farrah Fawcett Majors.
But...
Oh, my God.
They're about to discover...
We'll make a big soup.
Mr. Shatner, I would like to say that I think you are the greatest American actor ever.
I'm a Canadian.
That their lifelong hero...
I've got an idea.
...is definitely not of this world.
It's a musical version of Julius Caesar. I want to do the complete text.
Well, I'll play Julius Caesar and all the other parts, too.
The man I idolized since I was two turns out to be a raving loon.
Ouch.
And now...
My lady friend, you left me.
How can that be? I don't know. I mean, you're you.
He's going to lead them...
How cool is that?
...on a voyage...
Oh, my.
...to find love.
Guys, you gotta mix a little reality in with your imagination.
That's way stranger than science fiction.
I'm not the one with the green girl sex fantasy.
Oh, my.
Did you see the way that she was peeping you?
I don't believe it.
I just met the most fantastic female.
Claire.
You should be happy for her.
When Spock got infected by the spores and fell in love with Leela Kalomi, he was happy too. But Kirk fought him, made him resist.
Yeah, whatever.
Who do you see starring in it?
Rafer Weigel, Eric McCormick, Audie Englin, Patrick Van Horn, Phil LaMarr, and William Shatner.
And that Dr. Spock guy with those pointy ears.
As Bill.
You can call me Mr. Shatner now.
No tears for Caesar. The evil that men do lives after them. The good is often turned with their bones.
No one will ever believe this.
Free Enterprise. Love long, yeah, and party.
Dance with the captain.
Oh, yeah.
It's an homage to Star Trek, yeah, that people love, and I thank you for it. I think it's a tribute to Bill Shatner. It's and a celebration of Star Trek.
Yeah.
But it's not a Star Trek movie.
Right.
The sequel would have been, but but yeah, so
it's it's an important distinction.
I agree. And I deeply, deeply appreciate when people come up to me and say, oh, it's my favorite Star Trek movie. But I don't think it is a Star Trek movie. I think it's something else entirely, yeah, but that's not a bad thing.
No, not at all. I was just thinking of more of a Western that could absolutely be in the Star Trek vein. 1939's John Ford film Stagecoach.
What fascinating stories there were in the life of a stagecoach. And in the lives of its courageous passengers who found romance in danger and understanding in strange companionships. From the adventures of these American frontier characters, John Ford has created a truly great motion picture, Stagecoach. A drama as forceful and as true as The Informer and as gripping as The Hurricane.
Yeah, that's
true.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah, I could see that.
Here we are, a small group of people who are out of their element, traveling to a strange place via a manner that they are not familiar with. And there are a couple of learned and experienced people to help them through this. But transposing that into a Star Trek format would be amazing. Everybody on a shuttle.
And the Ringo kid played by John Wayne is very much a Star Trek character.
Absolutely.
Guy is kind of a villain, but he's not really. And he turns out to be, a good hearted guy. And who basically
he's a villain because he's had to learn to be tough to survive.
Yeah. But Stagecoach is so much fun. And again, a movie that a lot of our audience may not have seen.
Absolutely.
And you have the chance, there's a beautiful Criterion Blu-ray of it. I think it plays the Criterion. I think it may be on HBO Max under their Criterion or TCM hub. But it's a terrific, fun, delightful. Of course, we're talking about the original, not the remake.
Right.
Here's one that's maybe out of the box in a different direction than I normally go. It's it's not, the story is not a Star Trek story, but it's the kind of premise that I think would fit comfortably in Star Trek. And I think maybe actually did now that I think about it, but primarily as a Next Generation episode, The Truman Show.
Oh, that's interesting. I could kind of see that.
I mean, if you sort of imagine like Future Imperfect as a version of The Truman Show, mm-hmm, right? Or it's like, you know, Riker thinks that he's in the future, but really he's just being observed and it's all just this reality that's constructed around. Like, there's a version of that that I think is maybe interesting, but even if it weren't, right, it's, I just find that, I don't know how
in a strange way, the cage is almost like that.
Yeah, true.
And that Enterprise episode Observer Effect, where the Organians are monitoring humanity on the Enterprise, you know, not that I'm holding it up as a great episode or anything, but, you know, I could see how that, you know, I could see how the Truman Show potentially, you know, could be. And, it, you know, it has that idea in Star Trek in a way that, that true love will transcend everything. You know, the woman who tried to warn Truman and then eventually reunites with him. And it's a mind bender, you know, and even there's no one who's really evil in that. Even Ed Harris, I think, thinks he's doing good. Mm-hmm. So, you know, as Rob would say, they're only antagonists, no villains.
Right. I think that what is true for so many of these picks we have is that it's not necessarily the story or the settings, but it's the quality of the characters that make right. it, you know, yeah. Connect to Star Trek, because the Star Trek that we love has these quality characters, and they have depth, and they have consistency, and they have traits that are laudable.
That's why my favorite Star Trek movie of the 90s is Crimson Tide, mm-hmm. which to me yeah. is totally a Star Trek, and in fact, it even references Star yeah. Trek with right. Them talking about, you know, Denzel Washington telling, you know, he needs more power, like be like Scotty. In some dialogue that was actually written by Quentin Tarantino, who did an uncredited polish on the film. But the sort of two men at loggerheads of Denzel and Gene Hackman, you yeah. know, and they're both right and they're both wrong. Yeah. It makes it, to me, a really, really Star Trekian conceit. And obviously, you know, the sub action and everything that's at stake, it, you know, it has the stakes, you know, the operatic stakes of, you know, global Armageddon that Star Trek often had, you know, to me, Crimson Tide, and also great dialogue, you know, great acting. It's a terrific movie that doesn't get the love now that it should, because I think it's largely overshadowed by Hunt for Red October, which is also a terrific right. movie. But I love Crimson Tide, my favorite me Tony too. Scott movie.
As you no doubt heard, my XO has appendicitis. Your name was at the top of the list.
Well, that's good to know, sir.
It was a short list.
There's trouble in Russia. So they called us. And we're going over there and bringing the most lethal killing machine ever devised.
The last time we hit this state of emergency was 32 and a half years ago during the Cuban Missile Crisis. So this is what it's all about, gentlemen. It's what we train for.
Submerge the ship.
Diving officers, submerge the ship, make a depth 150 feet.
On the 1MC, dive!
This year...
We have a properly formatted emergency action message from National Command Authority.
What we've always known...
Bravo, Echo, Charlie, Alpha.
...becomes what we've always feared.
Gentlemen, this is the captain. Russian rebels have threatened to launch against our country and are fueling right now. This is not a drill.
Now.
Sir, we have a possible submerged submarine.
You find out who that is.
Receiving emergency action message. Recommend alert one.
The battle for survival begins.
That's a message fragment.
Sir, we don't know what this message means. Our target package could have changed.
I've made a decision.
There's no place for fear.
He's lost his nerve.
I'd rather go out myself and get this one wrong.
There's no room for mistakes.
If we launch and we're wrong, what's left of Russia is going to launch at us.
I'm captain of this boat. I don't have to think this over.
There's no time for doubt.
The missile system's ready to launch in 6 minutes.
You repeat this order or I'll find somebody who will.
Hell no, you won't, sir.
And nothing can stop the tide.
God, sonar torpedoes in the water!
Right forward!
1,000 yards of closing dive! Make your depth 1,200 feet! Hang on, everybody!
We cannot launch our missiles unless both you and I agree.
Fire! They're fueling their missiles!
He's right on top of us!
Place commando under arrest on a charge of mutiny!
Lock Captain Ramsey's in his stateroom.
Fire one! Now!
Give me the missile key, Mr. Hunter.
Sir, we are going down.
I'm the commander of this ship!
Crimson Tide.
God help you if you're wrong.
If
If I'm wrong, then we're at war. God help us all.
Me too. I mean, well, my favorite Tony Scott movie is True Romance, but Crimson Tide is a close second. But, you know, what I love about that movie the most is that the conflict, right, the sort of the moral reality of the conflict is not obvious, right? Now, we're inside of Denzel Washington's point of view. Like, we want to believe that Denzel Washington is right, but we cannot dismiss Gene Hackman. Because the scenario is set up like just so cleverly that because we're in a black box, because we're getting the message like one letter at a time, right? Because we don't know and the stakes are so high, it makes the choice that everybody is facing really interesting. Yeah. It makes the idea, it almost makes it play like, and it's really kind of what the judgment is on everybody at the end, that really nobody committed mutiny, like everybody did their duty. And it's just kind of an effed up situation, right? That like that nobody anticipated. And it's just, that's what I love about it. And I even love that at the end, it's like, there is that kind of mutual, it's Gene Hackman and Denzel Washington don't come out of that meeting with the adjutant, like at each other's throats or hating each other. They come out of it with just this respect, you know, of, yeah, you were doing your job and you were doing your job, right? And we can both respect that. And I think that's what's great about it.
There's very erudite conversations about von Clausewitz and about philosophy and war and the whole idea that in the nuclear era, the real horror is war itself. Right. You know, it's like some really interesting, you know, sort of provocative topics in a popcorn melodrama that it deals with. And that's what Star Trek also did very well. It dealt, you know, provocatively in a popcorn kind of way with some very deep issues. It took Nixon to go to China. Okay. I'm lining up Steve Asbell. We have a show coming up. It's going to be Darren versus Steve Asbell about Star Trek VI. They're going to go at it. Darren as the con, not con, K-H-A-N, as C-O-N, and Asbell is the pro, and they're going to go at it, and Ashley and I are going to moderate.
I look forward to it.
It's going to be great. He has to prepare. I think he's a little worried about you.
He's out chasing chickens in the backyard.
Ashley and I are going to go ding ding with the bell. It's going to be great. I'm not quite sure how we're going to do that. We're going to get thrown some Rocky music. It's going to be great. And that's not to be confused with our commentary that we're going to be doing on Don't Tell Anyone Star Trek 3. It's coming from Inglorious Trekspert soon.
Is it going to be on an entirely different podcast?
It's going to be on this podcast. It's not going to be on an entirely different. It might be on the other podcast. I don't know. Maybe it'll be on both feeds. Maybe something of that magnitude should be on both feeds.
So too big for one podcast.
So that's all those
right. It's a crossover with itself.
So all those people who say, I don't want to listen to you talk about Star Trek 3. We'll have no choice because it'll be on both podcast feeds.
It'll be the biggest download in the history of the show.
I don't know. We've had some pretty huge shows.
So. You know what? It might be a good idea to put half of it on here and half of it on.
Oh, then they realize it's an entirely different podcast. that's a clever idea.
That's a great idea.
You're a sorcerer, that one. By the way, I would be remiss if I didn't mention, of course, and you guys will laugh. This is for talk about a Star Trek wannabe or Star Trek movie, Destination Moonbase Alpha.
The moon has become a vast, complex space station. Suddenly, frightened, blasted out of Earth orbit, destined to journey forever. Deeper and deeper into the unknown. Destination Moonbase Alpha, an epic adventure across the universe to experiences beyond the imagination of any Earth-bound human. Where human extinction on Moonbase Alpha may be seconds away.
which is the movie version of Bringers of Wonder from Space 1999. And if ever there was a wannabe Star Trek, it was Space 1999 season two under the aegis of Fred Freiberger.
That's right.
Trying to get it right again and failing
again.
Well, yeah, I'm not out there to defend season two of Space 1999, but I enjoyed it. But I completely understand those that believe the opposite.
It had great spaceships, lasers.
Yeah.
The new music from Derek Wadsworth was great too. I mean, you had the Barry Gray music, which was awesome in the first season. Then the second season, you had Derek Wadsworth and the music was awesome. Yeah. By the way, I'm going to give you a little spoiler for No Time to Die. The Hans Zimmer score.
Awesome.
One of the few good things about it.
Cool.
Yeah, the Hans Zimmer score is great. And he uses a couple of key Bond themes beyond the main title theme, which is, which is great. So I'm not going to say anything more about that.
Thank you.
But at Destination Movie Base Alpha, as I said on our sister show, 4:30 Movie, also one of the great one sheets, gorgeous one sheet for Destination Movie Base Alpha.
Got big letters on it.
So it's like, also Star Trek movies have nice one sheets. Well, some of them.
Yeah.
Some of them.
Some of them.
Well, some of them.
Like the motion picture and the Bob Peak version of Star Trek 2.
Yeah.
And
Star Trek Insurrection. No.
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 You know what? I don't think any of the other. I think that's kind of it, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, none of them really. The rest of them aren't very good one sheets.
No.
I'm thinking. No. I'm going through my head. Nope. No. Not really. Not
of
great.
Everyone's
one-sheets.
Shouting at their audio devices right now.
Steve Asbell is about to message me, I'm sure.
The Star Trek the Star Trek one sheet, Star Trek 6 one sheet is not bad.
Right.
I like the Star Trek. But it's certainly derivative of everything else.
Yeah. But the rest of them not so good. Okay. Where do we fall? You know, I guess if you're doing Star Trek in the Picard vein, then maybe Starship Troopers would qualify for this.
What's going on? War! We're going to war!
Now the youth of tomorrow must travel across the stars to defend our world.
We are a generation commanded by fate to defend humankind.
Everyone fights, no one quits.
We are going in with first wave. You smash the entire area. You kill anything that has more than two legs. You get me?
We get you, sir!
But they will face an enemy more devastating than any ever imagined.
Here it comes!
Incoming!
TriStar Pictures takes you to the front lines of the next frontier.
Kill them all!
Starship Troopers.
Where it's sort of a different take on Earth and
no, I think that the problem with Starship Troopers is that if you're paying attention, people are bad.
That's what I'm saying. That's why in Picard, the Federation's kind of bad. They're kind of
not yet. Oh, you mean the new Picard?
He means the new Picard.
Yeah, I mean the new Picard, not the Picard
brand
we
new
know
cherry
love.
Flavor Picard.
Well, I mean, I think my personal opinion is that I thought we were talking about Star Trek.
Ouch, okay. Girlfriend!
Wow.
Okay, so
on that note, look, we talk. Hey, we're lovers.
Needle scratch.
We're lovers, not we're lovers, not haters on the show. Yeah. So we're gonna move on.
I
to,
love shows
stuff we
Star
love.
Trek.
Well, there was my pick when the 4:30 movie did the actual Star Trek movies that aren't Star Trek movies.
Right.
Yeah. I believe my pick was Guardians of the Galaxy, and I would stand by that.
That show was In the Shadow of Star Trek Week.
Okay, fair.
Which was a follow-up to our popular In the Shadow of Star Wars Week. So it was kind of movies that were inspired by the success of these things. This is a little different. We're saying movies that feel
like
have Star the feel Trek. Of a Star Trek episode.
Are we going to do In the Shadow of Space
in another universe? We could have called them Star Trek.
Right.
yes. Poor friend. You don't know.
Speaking of which, okay. So Darren started us off with clearly the right answer for all of us. The movie that is the most Star Trek-y of all of these. And that's Master and Commander, The Far Side of the World. You have a main characters, very much the Bones Kirk relationship with Russell Crowe and Vision.
Although he's both Bones and Spock.
Yes, very much so, isn't he? Yeah. Yeah. And there's lots of scenes in the briefing room.
I would argue that his cook, Killick, is more McCoy.
Right. Yeah.
Interesting.
All okay. I know is they gave him a ship with children on it.
That's right. The powder.
That's
monkey.
True.
And he stayed at his post when the trainees ran.
He did, and he lost his arm.
Yeah.
That's great. And then, of course, there was also like the Romulan commander, the commander of the French ship. Yeah. He's a sorcerer, that one. And what a great ending. What a great twist.
It's a great ending. It's a great ending.
If you haven't seen it, again, highly recommended. I haven't read the books. I know they're very popular book series, but the movie's terrific. And
the great thing about it is that the books started coming out in the early 70s. So I would argue that they are absolutely influenced by Star Trek.
If you can make that case, I think you can make that. But there are moments where you feel like you're watching a Star Trek movie. And when they get to the far side of the world, it's like they beamed down to an alien planet.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, they went down to Genesis.
Galapagos is an alien planet.
It's guys, the structure of Star Trek II is Master and Commander. I mean, I would argue that like up one side and down the other, that that the structure of that film came from those books. And that things were just which is casting no shade on anything, right? It's right. It's great poets borrow, a good poets borrow, great poets steal. And it's awesome. But you can see, there's the Mitara Nebula scene. Yep. Right now they're going down to Genesis and we got to hang out on Genesis a little bit, but wait,
the whole storm where they're chasing him in the storm.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the Mitara Nebula.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. Except they can't, except it is all two-dimensional thinking. Now, if Captain Jack Aubrey had managed to descend into the ocean to take out the French ship, then I'd be like,
right.
Wow. And then there was a part where Paul Bettany had to, go into the reactor chamber.
I shall avenge you.
No, wait, that didn't happen. But you know what I mean.
Absolutely. No.
Yeah.
When I was down in Mexico working on it and I got to read the script for the first time, I said, holy cow, it's Star Trek. Absolutely. From the script, you could absolutely tell. So.
Yeah. No, that's great. We, it's funny because we did an episode of Pandora, which was basically Logan's Run. Yeah. And, so that was also fun. It was a little dash of Star Trek and a little dash of Logan's Run. And it was the same thing. And you could throw in these little homages. So the planet they land on is Clayton's World, named after George, Clayton, who wrote Logan's Run. Yeah. And it was fun. It also it was CW, which was, so it was fun.
Was it
to
sponsored
do those little
by
homages.
Plankton, sea greens and protein.
No, in that case, it was not. But yeah, Master and Commander seems like the textbook Star Trek movie that wasn't. And Russell Crowe, at the height of his powers, is somebody who had the same charisma and dangerous energy of a young Shatner, where he could be charismatic, he could be dangerous. You believe him in a fist fight. He could be larger than life. He could be funny. And you could believe him being a little tortured. So he had the qualities of Shatner as Kirk too, as command, and also very smart and calculating and obsessed, because he didn't want to give up. He could have turned around and gone back to England, but he doesn't do it. It's much like, Kirk in Obsession or in Galileo 7, where he's not going to give up looking for Spock in the Galileo 7. And, so many times or Balance of Terror.
I mean, the upshot is that my perfect casting for a Star Trek movie reboot would have been Russell Crowe as Captain Kirk, Hugo Weaving as Spock, and Gary Sinise as Dr. McCoy.
Right, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Well, it depends. Are you remaking Star Trek VI?
That's correct. That's correct. But you know, the fact that the fact that Crow is so good in that movie, and that he has both the aspect of seriousness and professionalism to know what to do in these situations. He's really smart, but he also is a good captain that gets gets the best out of his crew.
Yeah,
and he knows how to deal with them, every one of them, and it's really well done.
And then when he gets mad at you, he throws a communicator at you. That's you gotta duck. Okay, maybe not. But boy, I'd watch that as a Star Trek movie in a heartbeat.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah, no, for sure. And you know, I'll just throw one thing out there before we wrap up. You know what this is really out there. You know what has the feeling of Star Trek?
Wicker Man?
No. Ted Lasso. It has the optimism and the heart of Star Trek and the relationship between the Troika. And I know it's a crazy, crazy thought, but you know, to me, some of the things that I love about Star Trek, you know, are and Ted Lasso. You guys are looking at me like I've lost my mind.
I fully respect your right to pick things that I may not agree with all the time. This is one of those cases.
As do I. I can't wait for the thriller in Manila when Darren Doctorman and Steve Asbell go at it. It's going to be blood on that tarmac.
Well,
in this corner, it's the president of 20th Pictures. In the other corner, it's this guy.
Can't wait. I can't wait. It's going to be great. It's going to be magical.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But those are some really, I think, great picks by everybody. Even you, Ashley. I love them.
Thank you. And so do you.
Yeah, yeah. And I, you know, these are all movies that anyone doing Star Trek in the 21st century should look at for inspiration, don't you think?
Yeah, 100%.
And you know, with stories like these out there, there is absolutely no reason you should have a bad Star Trek. Absolutely none.
And if you're doing Galactica, you should look at Zero Hour.
That's correct.
Yeah. Okay. Well, this is great. This is a really interesting show, as always. And thank you, gentlemen, for you know,
whatever it is we do.
For what we do, and we're going to be back with some new episodes. We have still coming up Revelations, the Enterprise Bible episode, and we're going to do Exodus, which is going to be Deep Space Nine, the Deep Space Nine Bible. So we're going to continue our deep dive into the writers and directors Bibles of the various Star Trek series coming in on future episodes of Inglourious Treksperts. And of course, our guest hosts, Peter and Lisa, will be back with some special treats as well. You can always listen to our audio commentaries into significant Star Trek episodes on Treksperts Briefing Room, an entirely different podcast from the one you're listening to. You need to subscribe to Treksperts Briefing Room, and you also need to rate them 5 stars to let people know you're digging what they're doing. I know Peter and Lisa have had a couple of shows recently that have just hit it out of the park with Brian Absolutely. Fuller and Denise Crosby and Professor Muhammad Moore.
Oh, no, they haven't gotten William Shatner yet.
They didn't get William Shatner.
I fully expect to find out that one morning.
I don't think there's any danger of that happening. And you saw George Takei was down at Ticonderoga.
Yeah, absolutely.
In his original Star Trek regalia. That was pretty fun.
It was absolutely fun. And it looks like George had a great time.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
And Brad.
And it looks like they're making progress on their next generation sets as well.
Absolutely.
Well, that's great for James and everyone at Ticonderoga. And I'm looking forward to getting a chance to get down there at some point, as I know Ashley is as well.
For sure.
So if you're a fan of this podcast, I hope you'll listen to our sister podcasts, Treksperts Briefing Room, an entirely different podcast, Beth Bowie's Never Made, Fourth Day Movie, as well as Cartoon Bar Room with Ashley and Steve. Always a fun time on Saturday mornings. And a special thanks to Natalie Miscali, Zach Ragus, Peter Holmstrom, and of course, our fabulous sound engineer, the great Bill Ritter, who continues. I can't believe it. It's like almost 2 years now, and we're still doing this remotely. Yeah. And thank you, Bill, for making us sound so good and making sure the clips get integrated into the, although no clip from Das Boot.
I was going to say, good luck with the German.
Wait, there is a dubbed version, but there's no way we're putting that in. We're not dignifying that with the presence in our show. And of course, today is the premiere of No Time to Die, and I'll be interested in hearing your feedback on that on social and talking to you gentlemen about it offline. And then, of course, you can follow us at Inglourious Trek on Twitter, Inglourious Treksperts on Treksperts, Inglourious Treksperts on Instagram and on Facebook. So until next week, when we return with an all-new episode of Inglourious Treksperts, on behalf of Ashley, Darren Doctorman, and myself, Mark A. Altman, keep on trekking, ingloriously, of course. Engage.
You're listening to the Electric Surge Network.